Did someone just turn the lights on in the housing market?
Or is it just an illusion?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, August 30th.
Coming up, we've got the latest numbers from the housing market. Home prices are going up just a tiny bit.
Also, the race to help Libya rebuild.
And from one questionable invention to another, grilled cheese goes high tech.
The gooey details are just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Now let's get to housing. The S&P Case-Shiller Index is out this morning, and it says home prices were up 1.1% in June. That's the third straight monthly increase. But year over year, they were down 4.5%. Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, explain these numbers. We have home prices going up month to month, but down year to year.
Well, it shows that it's three straight months of rising prices, but it really is all by region. The Sand States, Florida, Arizona, California, Nevada still really aren't showing real signs of life yet. But the rest of the country is making very slight progress. And if you combine that with increased consumer spending, there is a little bit of hope out there.
A little bit of hope. So you would say that overall this is a good number?
It's not bad, and that's the only news we can expect these days, because cutting interest rates, historic low interest rates, it hasn't made any difference. The housing inventory is still huge. You've got about 7 million in foreclosure, and the lower house prices, lower priced houses are the ones that are not seeing any pickup. It's the high end. We have to move that 7 million in inventory before you really get any kinds of job recovery, any kind of recovery, and that's basically going to be jobs, hanging on to the income, existing household debt getting to manageable levels.
Well, as you say, the interest rates are already at very low levels. Is there something more that the government or anybody else should be doing right now to boost the housing market further?
Well, there's nothing the Fed can do, but what the government can do is step in through Fannie and Freddie, the housing lenders of last resort. They can help with the refinancing. A lot of homeowners have 7-8% mortgages and can't refinance because of the new tougher standards. The house has to be 20% more than what you're owing on it currently. That's a tough thing to do with the dropping prices. If they could refi at today's lower prices, you get 4.5% rates. That unleashes huge spending power and direct stimulus to the economy, and homeowners are less likely to default and walk away from the problems, making it even worse.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much as always.
You bet.
Well, for some American families, home dwelling is taking a trip back to the future. New census data show in this tough economy and an even tougher housing market, the number of multi-generational households has surged. What are multi-generational households? Well, those are homes where children, parents and grandparents, three generations or more, all live under one roof. Well, let's talk a bit about this new trend. Philip Cohen is professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina. He's with us now from Chapel Hill. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Why are more people of different generations living together, and how does this affect them all?
Well, the first thing that happens is that people turn to those they expect to care for them, or people that have some moral obligation. And whether it's young people looking up a generation or old people looking down a generation, the family is the first place that people have to turn.
Is this because of economic conditions? I mean, is that particularly the reason why?
We've seen for a long time that people tend to live in multi-generational households when they don't have as much choice as they'd like. So it seems like Americans, when they can afford to, don't do this. So when we see a strong uptick in multi-generational living, we have to suspect that it's economic, although, frankly, the numbers have been trending up since the middle of the decade.
How does this bode for the rest of the economy, though? I mean, does this mean more sharing of groceries and other toiletry items, less shopping, less spending?
Well, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it may be more efficient for families. It may reduce the total number of households and increase economies of scale within families. I have seen at least one report that builders are getting more requests for so-called in-law suites in some areas. So there, if you are taking it seriously and you have some money to spend, then it certainly is another opportunity to spend some money.
Very quickly, sir, is this temporary or are these permanent living situations?
Well, the long-term decline in multi-generational living made us think that it would never turn around, and the steep steep increase in the last few years has us wondering. I don't know.
Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bank of America has just taken a drastic step in search of cash. It is selling half of its stake in the China Construction Bank, which gave B of A a way into the fast-growing Chinese real estate market. So is Bank of America cutting off its future to save its present? Here's Marketplace's Eve Troeh.
Bank of America needs cash fast, $50 billion, to convince investors and international regulators that it's strong. So it's been selling assets, like its credit card business in Canada and Europe, and now billions of shares in China Construction Bank. That gets Bank of America more than $3 billion closer to its goal. Arthur Kroeber at Dragonomics Research in Beijing says even though it was a fire sale, they got a good deal.
It's very unlikely that China Construction Bank's stock price is going to be much higher 2 or 3 or 5 years from now.
That's because Chinese banks have been lending a lot in recent years. Eventually, they'll need to show more capital, the way Bank of America has to do right now. That could limit growth. B of A still holds 5% of China Construction Bank and plans to continue what both are calling a strategic partnership. But Kroeber says the Chinese bank hasn't treated B of A much like a partner since it bought in. It seemed to mostly just want the money. And there are now plenty of other investors willing to provide that. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Steve, did you hear about this mea culpa that we just got?
Oh, someone said I'm sorry.
They did. No. It was the head of the world's largest mutual fund, which is not doing so well right now. I'm talking about PIMCO.
Oh, Bill Gross.
And good old Bill Gross. He says now that he bet wrong when he sold all of his firm's U.S. government bonds over inflation concerns. Of course, the interest rate on 10-year bonds dipped to historic lows last month, and Gross is now quoted as saying, "Do I wish I had more treasuries?" Yeah, that's pretty obvious.
Mea culpa. Yeah, no sorries here at Marketplace.org, Jeremy, but we do have some numbers there.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. The interim rulers in Libya today announced a deadline of Saturday for forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi to surrender or face military force. And now that the Gaddafi regime is coming to an end, or likely coming to an end, some countries stand to gain while others stand to lose.
We have two reports now, one from Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Shanghai on how China may face an uphill battle now that the Libyan dictator is likely gone. A dictator China supported. But first, a report from the tiny Gulf state of Qatar, which supported the rebels and in return hopes for some economic benefit. Here's the BBC's Simon Atkinson.
Qatar sent money, weapons and expensive fighter jets to the Libyan rebels during the uprising. In fact, Qatar's capital Doha has become something of a home away from home for Libyan opposition leaders. Dean is a TV producer working for a Free Libya TV satellite channel that broadcasts out of Doha. She thinks Libyans will always be grateful for Qatar's support.
For different reasons, you know, the Arab world has not been able to step up. But Qatar is, I would say, an exception.
So what does Qatar want in return? Well, clearly now it's going to have some political influence. But there are potential economic benefits too. Qatar-based companies are going to be well positioned to win lucrative construction contracts. And that's because Libya is going to be spending money to rebuild infrastructure battered by airstrikes. The Libyan rebel government already said it's going to tap their regional allies to help sell their vast oil and gas supplies. In Dubai, I'm the BBC's Simon Atkinson for Marketplace.
I'm Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Here are the stakes for China. It's invested $20 billion in Libya. 35,000 Chinese workers were employed there, and 3% of China's imported oil comes from Libya. Now China stands to lose all of this because it placed its bets on the wrong guy. William McCahill is a former senior American diplomat who's now a financial services consultant in Beijing.
Now with Gaddafi ousted and the rebels having formed a new regime, the Chinese are trying, in a sense, to recapture the commercial interests that they had. And they're having some difficulty in doing that.
The new Libyan state oil company says China may lose out on future oil contracts. That's because earlier this year, China declined to vote on a UN referendum to help protect Libyan civilians. McHale says China's booming economy needs that oil. One example, China's adding 14 million cars a year. So any drop in the oil supply threatens Chinese productivity. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Syrian troops today opened fire on thousands of protesters in several cities across the country. The violent crackdown comes as the Muslim holiday of Ramadan wraps up. Now, meanwhile, officials from the 27 countries that make up the European Union meet today in Brussels to talk about expanding sanctions against the Syrian government. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on that story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So what sanctions are we talking about here?
A ban on doing business with Syrian companies that support the Assad regime. Specifically, they're talking about Syrian companies in banking, telecoms and energy. EU ministers have already reached a preliminary agreement on an oil embargo against Syria. Details of that are still being hammered out. Final agreement is expected on the whole package by the end of this week.
Is this going to have any effect, Stephen?
Of course, there's always doubt about the effectiveness of economic sanctions. For example, although Syria sells 90% of its crude oil to the European Union, analysts point out China and India, who are not party to this sanctions package, would probably be happy to buy the oil instead. But as Chris Phillips of the Economist Intelligence Unit told the BBC, the EU sanctions could have some effect.
It might actually persuade some members of the regime to turn on the leadership, recognising that the economic consequences of them staying in power in the long run will damage the economy.
The US, by the way, has already imposed its own oil embargo and a ban on American companies investing in Syria.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
While the EU eyes sanctions on Syrian oil imports, in Egypt, the petroleum sector is one of the few areas flourishing in the months since the ousting of President Hosni Mubarak. The economy's been pretty dicey otherwise in Egypt. Reporter Julia Simon has more now from Cairo.
The large blue iron gate opens as a few businessmen enter the Egyptian Ministry of Petroleum. 23-year-old lawyer Ali Mohamed Ibrahim is rushing on his way to the ministry.
After the revolution, Egypt has changed, and any person or company should be able to visit the minister.
Good luck, I tell him. The revolution hasn't made Egypt's oil and gas sectors any less busy. Angus Blair of the Egyptian investment bank Beltone Financial says that's no surprise.
The hydrocarbon sector is probably the most immune to political change. Oil companies have seen change all over the world, and they're used to it.
About 15% of Egypt's GDP comes from oil and gas, or about $31 billion a year. Since the revolution 6 months ago, investment in those sectors has held up, but other areas like real estate and tourism have seen sharp declines. Tom Voidovich is the Egypt country manager for Houston-based energy company Apache Corporation.
We've reached this pace of about $1 billion a year, and that works comfortably for us.
Apache is the largest American investor in Egypt and just reported two new oil wells in Egypt's western desert.
They would be the 12th and 13th discoveries we've made in the western desert in 2011.
Yet while most of Egypt's oil and gas is used domestically, some is exported, and Egypt's gas exports to Israel are hugely controversial. Angus Blair says since the revolution, the pipelines in the Sinai have been attacked 5 times.
It is of concern to a lot of people, not just the hydrocarbon sector, because it's very important in terms of revenues for Egypt that the gas pipeline keeps flowing.
But Blair says the Egyptian government implemented a new strategy to protect its gas. They're now paying Bedouin tribesmen to stand guard. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, an Australian man has learned the hard way. Don't store your wife's expensive gold jewelry in garbage bags.
He had to learn that lesson.
Yes,
the hard
he
way.
Did. I told him so many times, don't do that. Well, the man put the items in the bags because he wanted to fool any potential robbers. He thought, wow, they're not going to think that they're in these bags. Well, instead, the man fooled himself because when he threw the trash out in his house, the trash, of course, that was in the same kind of bags, he threw the jewelry out with it.
Oh, that's too bad.
To the tune of $5,000 worth. Because the guy didn't realize what he'd done until a couple of days later, garbage collectors say there is no telling where that prized bag wound up, which dump it's in or under what pile of trash. The good news is, though, Jeremy, as you know, gold is down from its record highs earlier in the month.
So it could have been worse.
Could have been a lot worse. Could have been worth like $60,000 or something like that.
Well, as parts of the East Coast clean up from Hurricane Irene, economists, insurance companies, and government officials are tallying up the cost of the disaster, and they're coming up with some very different figures. University of Maryland economist Peter Morici is with us now to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm seeing a lot of different numbers out there for how much this hurricane is going to cost in the end. The Wall Street Journal is saying $12 billion. Another estimate says $7 to $10 billion. And you yourself say $45 billion. How do we know which figure to trust here?
Well, all of these are estimates. You look at past hurricanes and the kind of damage that they did to get the property damage. Although it was only a Category 1, the flood damage is of enormous magnitude and very difficult to compute because a lot of it is not covered by insurance. A Category 1 normally gives us about $14 billion in property damage. However, because of the flooding, I've raised my estimate on property damage to $20 billion. As for the lost business, we'll lose about 2 days' economic activity over the next 2 weeks in those areas. So I come up with another $20 to $25 billion.
But that seems very specific for something that, you don't know if somebody's going to go shopping here or go to a restaurant there and figure out what the economic damage will actually be.
That's true. However, we do know that from past disasters that a certain amount of shopping doesn't happen. Some of it gets shifted around, but some of it doesn't happen. Now, a good deal of that business will come back later, but there will be an immediate impact, just like there will be rebuilding. Normally, rebuilding is very costly to a society, but in this case, it won't be, simply because we have so many unemployed resources in the construction industry.
Do you think that this is going to be something that we will see in the GDP figures that come out, that this will be a big enough impact from Hurricane Irene that we'll actually see it in our economic growth?
We're going to get a total rebuilding, in my judgment, of about $30 billion between rebuilding and folks deciding to do better. That often happens after a disaster. We actually expand our capital stock. But that'll be spread over many quarters. It'll be spread over, 2 to 3 years with a tailing effect after that. So, in the first quarter of next year, you see $10 billion. That's not a lot.
Peter Morici, economist at the University of Maryland. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Nice to be with you.
The University of Southern California is launching a campaign to raise $6 billion in the next several years. I said $6 billion.
Wow.
It is a large sum of money. It would be a record for college fundraising. So why does USC think it can happen in this economy? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
With the market swinging around and the economy looking gloomy, this may not seem like the best time to ask donors for large handouts. But Patrick Rooney with the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University says it's good to be first in line when things get better.
As the economy grows, typically philanthropy grows. And so to get out in front and to have a big, bold vision and a big, bold campaign probably has some advantages in the marketplace.
USC has already raised $1 billion in the early so-called quiet phase of its campaign. Al Cecchio is Senior Vice President for University Advancement. He says the key is to figure out what interests wealthy alumni and then connect them with programs they're excited about.
That is really the science and skill of fundraising. Through the course of that relationship, you determine what they're interested in, and then in many ways, it's almost like being a matchmaker.
Cecchio says half the money will go toward building the university's endowment to help attract big-name faculty and provide more scholarships. USC's endowment lags many of its peers. A larger pool of money would also help the university ride out the ups and downs of the economy. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, remember the flip video camera? It wasn't too long ago. It was supposed
to
be
very
the next,
small. You could put it in your pocket.
That's
yeah.
right. And it was supposed to be the next big thing. And that was a great plan until, you know, every smartphone in the world got a built-in video camera. And then you didn't need the Flip Video anymore. Well, now the founder of Flip Video has a new idea. He's launched a new venture, which is a chain of high-tech grilled cheese restaurants.
Mm, wow.
High-tech. I didn't know you needed to be
small
high-tech.
Small enough to fit in your pocket?
It sounds like a good business plan. These grilled cheese places are really doing well right now. Here are the details, by the way, in case you're interested. First, you order your grilled cheese using your mobile phone.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and then you that creates a QR code that you then take to the restaurant to scan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right. All right. Following so far?
Yeah.
And then your order appears on the order board.
Yeah.
Then your grilled cheese is put in a grill with a built-in microwave. And then the QR code... Well, anyway, it sounds like it's probably going to do better than the flip cam, I'm sure. I'm sure nothing could go wrong with this idea.
Well, I mean, you know, if you love cheese and in between two slices of bread, absolutely. We're in good shape.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.